Position number 21580, Reel 3.
Eric Blanchard, Reel 3.
Yes, the water sobered and managed to put his foot down and almost threw us into through the hull, on boating term now, almost. And he got the frostbite and from his foot a bit. But that was the only damage, really. And we didn't come back with holes, lots of holes, and jettled around. But it was quite a scary one, because for once we smelt it and heard it, and I don't suppose we did it once again like that. The other thing I do remember, a bit scared about, when we tootled off to Berlin, that's a long way, as you know, and the Germans had then put up some old bombers and seemed plotted our route quite well, and that particular time, I remember, they dropped flares in the sky, and that was quite scary. You thought, oh, we've gone like this, and I don't remember how many times they did it, but that particular night, I do remember, it was a Berlin raid, and the Germans had got this idea of.
Of what?
Well, they're dropping illuminated flares.
From where?
From aircraft that they're using old bombers, Dorniers, I think. One would have to check with our own bomber command people, that's what it was, I think.
So these were flying even higher than you were?
Yes, it would be, yes. But what was striking was, of course, they got the predicted route. Their ground boys have said, that's it. And they had decided it was Berlin. As you appreciate, some of the times, especially when we had got far more aircraft and we can send some out there and some there, the German controllers have got to say, where's the main thing going to be? Where should we put the fighters tonight? And because they get it wrong, they can get it right. And if they got it right, the casualty is certainly right. It's good.
There's another incident here. This is another Nuremberg operation. This is the 27th of August, 43. You put landed Swinderby aircraft written off on refueling and takeoff.
Ah, yeah, that wasn't us, though. They sent another pilot to do that. That was R.E. Easy. Yeah. So, yes, I don't know why we landed at Swindon. I can't think why. I don't say why, do I?
No.
No. But they sent... I know we were particularly evil towards the people that... a perfectly good aircraft, one we thought was good, that they go and wreck it for us. That's the only reason for that.
And a raid here on Berlin, the 1st of September 43, you put early return oxygen failure.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Do you remember that?
Well, I can't predict I don't know whose oxygen wasn't good. I can't tell you. It might have been the navigator.
And that operation only lasted 2 hours, 35
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, well, in fact, we'd have probably only got the knot across the North Sea and dropped the bombs on the Navy or something like that, you know.
And then 2 days later, the 3rd of September, 43, another operation on Berlin, you've put... USPO engine.
What
does PO stand for?
Port outer.
Then USMU turret, early return.
Yes, that's right. That's the mid of a gunner saying his turret isn't working and come home. Yeah, we didn't. That would be the captain saying, oh, I can't risk going all that way. We had one gunner.
And that was 3 hours, 35 minutes.
Yeah.
Then later, you've got 29th of September 1943, Operation to Bochum, early return, sick navigator. Do you remember that one?
No, I don't. Well, and Ernie was a stout old boy. I mean, he's an old man compared to us. He was 28, you see. And so we take his word for it.
And that was 3 hours, 10 minutes.
Yeah. Have you come across Turin?
Yes, you had an operation to Turin. Does that stick in your mind?
Oh,
that,
yes.
That
yes.
was the 12th of July.
Yes, a very, very, that's a very striking one, that. And the object of the exercise there was, it's in daylight. Coming home would be in daylight. So somebody dreamed up a marvellous return to it. And we were to come along the south of France, keep the Pyrenees on the port side, and out into the Atlantic Ocean. I think you'd have to look up the bomber command thing and in a queue to find out how far. I don't think we remember how far out we flew, but it was a long way out into the Atlantic, and we were told to drop down to sea level almost there, which is quite a dangerous thing because you could lose it and dive into the sea. And then as you approached Brittany, start climbing, and in theory there would be a fighter protection, and we did this, and but didn't see any fighters. By this time we're now coming along the English Channel, probably about 10 or 12,000 feet now, because we're nearly home. You can look out, and I remember being a Devonian, I did know one or two parts of the world, you know. And the argument there, the G, that's a very early radar gadget, wasn't working, and so the navigator and the bomber were their maps trying to decide what's what, and they said we'd passed Torquay because it's got a balloon barrage. And I said, no, Plymouth's got the balloon barrage, not Torquay. But they didn't take any notice of me. And they turned in to port. And I said, well, if you want to go to Exeter, that's our nearest one. Looking out, I then saw Dartmoor Prison. And I had been there before, not as a customer, but, you know, I'd been there. I knew what it looked like from the air as well, because the pictures we'd seen, and it's so obvious. And a little bit further on, if you're on the road, you would turn right for Dartmoor, to Exeter, and the A30 you want to us. But the navigator has some, not the navigator, the wireless submarine, it came up, the brilliant idea, at somewhere in Cornwall. He looked it up, and it's there. So we turned left instead of right. In other words, we turned west instead of east. Very soon, the mid-upper gunner screamed with his French accent, English accent, whatever we call it, there's a mountain, it's a mountain. What? And of course, it was Brown Willie, the highest peak in Cornwall. The next minute, of course, I mean, in, you know, at 180 miles an hour, it is a real couple of minutes. There's the coast. There's the surf. In America, next stop, you know. Oh, turn around. Where is this place? And we found it and landed there. One or two liberators were around, but there were only they were Polish liberators, apparently, Polish Coastal Juan people. We had a little sleep, put some fuel in the aircraft, and took off. And as my pilot had been born and bred in Torrington before moving to London, we passed over Torrington, over here, Lundy Island on the port, and over into Wales, and then at northeast, I suppose, to Scanton, where we landed. Of course, several hours after. Nobody posted us as missing, but unfortunately, the people in Cornwall hadn't told us Scanton that we were safe and sound. And all over the country, there were people landing. Some people, I've got a little do about Exeter Airport, and there's a picture there, and a man rang him a couple of years ago. I said, well, he landed at Exeter. He'd done it right, not us. So it's quite safe. We were all safe and sound. But that was the night a Wing Commander Nettleton, a VC, and a man that had led a very daring raid in daylight with Lancaster to Augsburg, and he didn't come back. And one of our own aircraft didn't come back as well that night. To us, it didn't seem a difficult raid, you know, it didn't seem a lot of flak, but I don't know. Some of it. Now, what else is there?
Any raids that stick out in your mind from your first tour? Any other incidents?
Well, yes, the very last one, of course, was a terrible storm. They were in terrible weather. That was to
Leipzig?
Leipzig, yes. That was terrifically bad weather.
So what happened to your aircraft in the bad weather?
Oh, no, nothing really bad. It was just the thunder and the lightning and the storms. And I would say it's just that we all remember it as a terrible weather.
Could you tell me exactly what you had to do as a flight engineer in the plane, please? Can you?
Yeah.
Be meticulous about specifying the job, please.
Yes. Oh, in the aircraft, first of all, you help control, depending on the pilot or not. That's what usually put the undercarriage up for him. You helped them push the throttles in through the gate, and you then reduced the pitch of the propellers and get the engine sounding in morning in tune, not vibrating. And of course, all the time, then you were monitoring all the different gauges, the flight engineer's gauges and the fuel consumption. And in theory, of course, you're writing it all down on a piece of paper. Every hour or so, you'd write down your fuel consumption and what the temperatures are and all that sort of thing. But once you got over the other side, it was all eyes out. Looking out in the blister, which is, you know, enabled to look out and look back and down. Directly got an enemy territory. I would say you looking at the gauges and things was quite incidental that I did. For that time, you said, oh, forget it. And then when the action's over and you're then and sit down and write it. And sometimes you put that down the flat for him. And sometimes, of course, if they get an injured pilot, some people actually flew them home. Sometimes the bomber who'd been a failed pilot, he would take over.
How frightened would you be on operations?
Well, yes, at times, you could be frightened when it, especially under attack or under the flak, especially in the target area. And I was never particularly frightened in the dark, because that was the dangerous thing. Well, you didn't know where they were. At that stage of the war, my skipper was a great one for obeying the rules and banking. We used to bank to starboard, bank to port. We change your course, and that was the more difficult for the Hun. If you got a bloke that was, the fighter was banking and having a look to see what. Oh, and if he's weaving, because it's more difficult to predict him by the ground chaps looking at what's this chap? He's going. Oh no, he's gone there. So the only thing was a navigator. For a navigator, that's more difficult for him, because you've gone off course, then you've gone here. And I mean, it's like me sailing the boat in the estuary here. If you do that sort of thing, you never get to London. Well, you could get to London, but you've got to be much more careful then. And so it's much more difficult than a navigator.
Was that LMF case the only one you came across, or
yes.
Were there others?
One in my second tour I've come across, yes, I'll tell you about that.
Well, let's go on to the second tour now. Can you tell me how you came to do the second tour, please?
Yes, I do. About sometime in 1944, which is on my piece of paper, I went on a course, a flight engineer's course, a flight engineer leader's course. That's a great test. So you go down to St. Athens again, but this time I'm commissioned. It's very, very different. Except the wars, the invasion hadn't long taken place. In their office this semester, they got a little map, might say, where we got to. I don't think we'd taken Caen by this time, so it's these early days. I was amazed to find them, suddenly they got in their civilian clothes and got their golf cart bags out and went. But this is not aircrew, of course. Not the types like me that are on the course. That did surprise us, or surprise me. And then I had not long returned to the station, which was then been renamed, by the way. It was a 5 Lancaster Finnish School, 5 standing for 5 group, you see. And Lancaster Finishing School, then the chap that had come to be the flight engineer leader at East Kirkby for my 57 squadron, that's called Flight Lieutenant Clark, he got killed in one of these easy daylights, as they call them. And I always said there's no easy up until you're back home and die. And so in a flash, I was posted straight away back to my squadron, which I'd been on, in the same station, now D's Kirkby. I was sent to be an acting flight lieutenant, big chief, you see. And so I went down to a very nice chap, the CO, Wing Commander Humphreys, and he said, "Oh, want to go on ops?" I said, "Oh, yes, I'll go." It's the one, yes, yes, you go tomorrow. There's a flight engineer needed for a flight lieutenant, Ainley. So I said, "Oh, I'll go. And I went on this daylight thing. I'd never been in daylight. This is marvelous, you know. I wanted to go and see what it's on. And it was really quite uneventful. We did two or three of these things. They were mostly flying bomb dumps. And then, of course, we got to another op, and that was quite incredible. That was a night to bomb the Germans before Caen. And another daylight was when it led, now got the Germans really on the move, and they were going, I think it was the Falaise Gap, it's called, and we went upon there and there, and supposed to be all these Germans easy to dealt with, but I think someone, some Canadians, right, currently, some of our Canadian troops got lumbered by some bombers, but I don't know who it was. But it was that was an incredible view. It looked down on the Mulberry Harbour and all the shipping around there and past that.
What do you remember about the raid on the Falaise Gap?
Oh, well, again, just you're using high explosive, so I don't remember a lot about it really. Other was a mop that did that, and I did then. I don't know quite a sequence, and I can find it out there. Because excuse me, I.
Oh. Well, I've got the sequence in your logbook.
Have you? Okay.
What is it you're thinking of?
Well, two things. One is the a raid on an aerodrome near Arnhem, Dillon. And that was I thought it was going to be uneventful. Dillon was the place actually when the German night fighter base was the controllers, all the control for a large part of Germany was there, but I don't think it was anything to do with that. We were just bombing aerodromes, and it was pre-Arnhem, it was before Arnhem. I do remember this aircraft flying all around, telling us to hurry up and bunch up. And that was Wing Commander Gibson, but I didn't know it at the time. And he had borrowed a Yankee twin-boom aircraft, the name of which has escaped me. But what I do remember, some horrible thing that happened then, when at night you don't see quite the same, and then suddenly Lancaster immediately in front of us disintegrated completely, like that, gone, and the wings kind of thin out and the engines thin out, bits and pieces came back to us tingling away. Luckily they didn't do any damage, and but it was unfortunate, the poor chap, I don't know whether he was hit by a bomb from above or a little bit of flak, I don't know. I really don't know. But he was.
Yes, that raid was on the 15th of August, according to your logbook.
Was it?
Any memories of a raid on the Stettin Canal?
Oh, yes. Mount Joost, yes, yes. Yes, miss. Very much. This is a raid which nobody's really written up about. I've done a couple of talks on it, and I actually got the, in my last, I put the full-size Admiralty chart on a piece of board, and I marked it out what it was. Yes, and that was an unusual raid, very unusual. Again, I was Flight Lieutenant Ainley, and there were only three or four aircraft from our squadron. Did you all mark with a load of mines? The mines are quite long things. They're not, you know, people imagine they are. They're quite long pieces of equipment. And I, in my office, I can tell you how many mines we've got on board. And the idea was to the briefing. I remember the briefing so vividly. The group captain, who was an old sickly, probably a First World War chap, he was very well known to us around. But he always had a lot of drink, and he could go to the briefing, and he stood there, and he told us that we'd see all the ships, big ships, they'd be anchored there, all the, and it's quite, you know, if I hadn't done a lot of Oxbow, because I've done 38 Oxbow this time, but I remember him around that briefing. Anyway.
What objection did you have to his briefing?
Well, no, how he was scaring the pants of us, telling us about all these vessels will be there, and all of course, obviously, a PRU, the photograph, then they knew they were there. Anyway, we set off and go across Denmark. We're travelling along the north coast of Germany towards what is now Poland, and there was to be a raid at a high level of the Stettin in the normal way. And so some of the aircraft are going to be that, and a few of us are going to do something totally different, to drop mines, but not in the sea, to drop mines low level. And we went there, so I could see flak on the starboard, and I thought, that's Peenemünde. That's Peenemünde, of course, was the where they developed the V-1 and the V-2 were being developed. And we made them in 1943 very badly. We did a lot of damage to them there. But that wasn't our crowd. That's the main force, probably actually accidentally got off track. I don't know. Anyway, the next one, we start to get lower, and we're then near sea level, probably 500 feet, and this big inland waterway, which is near Stettin. And we were told to wait there, and all but there, and that's our plan, you know, we've been told that before we, and that it will be a wing commander porter who would be marking the channel. And so at a certain time, the small Pathfinder force, and 5 group, we had two Pathfinder squadrons had been allocated to them, and one was 97 and the other was 83. And parachute flares are illuminating the whole area. And then, of course, Wing Commander Porter is going to try and lay mines along the channel. Well, he isn't going to lay mines, he's going to lay flame floats. Flame float, normally it's used for testing something and seeing it light and luminous. The channel was vital channel to get from Stettin to the Baltic Sea, and from the Baltic Sea to either Sweden, which brought in lots of things because they were neutral, or back to help the Russian front. you go east and you're shipping it to supply further up to Königsberg. But here we are, Stettin.